Okay. Good evening, everybody. Are you controlling the volume? There we are. Good evening, everybody. Good evening. I think we're going to get started now. Greetings, and thank you very much for coming tonight. My name is Michael Pollan, and I'm a journalist teaching in the Graduate School of Journalism here at Berkeley. And my job tonight is to welcome you all, those of you in this room, and thanks to the internet, those watching the proceedings in far-flung rooms around the world. We know in Mexico and France, and probably many other places. I want to say a few words about the critically important issue before us tonight, the suppression of scientific dissent, from the perspective of a journalist. And then I want to introduce our panel and then turn over the proceedings to this evening's moderator, Mark Dowie. I want to welcome you here tonight on behalf of the many, many organizations that collaborated to make this event possible. I shouldn't go first, but the Knight Program in Science and Environmental Journalism at the Graduate School of Journalism, the Bancroft Library Oral History of Biotechnology Project, the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at UC Berkeley, the Center for Sustainable Resource Development at UC Berkeley, the Berkeley Art Museum and its Genesis Project, the Council for Responsible Genetics, and the Jennifer Altman Foundation. What I think galvanized all these very disparate institutions to collaborate on this event was a shared sense that these are parlous times for scientific freedom in America and beyond. The blurring of the lines between public and private science, and the blurring of the lines between science and technology, perhaps, have changed the tenor of scientific discourse and diminished the tolerance for diversity and dissent. Not that tolerance of dissent is so alive and well elsewhere in the culture right just now. Just last month, a mildly critical miniseries about Ronald Reagan was yanked from the CBS television network. Last spring, you'll probably remember that a presidential candidate who joked about the need for regime change in Washington was all but charged with treason by the White House, as if regime change were not the very point of holding an election. And then, of course, there was that very silly episode, silly but serious episode, with the Dixie Chicks, who were excoriating for daring to criticize the president. But scientific dissent and suppression present a very special case, one that is much harder for those of us in the press to report on. And that's what I'd like to talk a little bit about today. Indeed, we don't even know how widespread this problem is. What you see before you here tonight are some pretty rare birds. Exceptional scientists willing to speak out, willing to go public. What we don't know is how many others have been silenced or intimidated into simply not asking troublesome questions, not designing controversial experiments. Perhaps our panelists can give us some idea. My fear, and this is based on my own experience as a journalist, especially writing about industrial agriculture, is that the population of such scientists is large and growing. Like most scientists, we journalists cling to a faith that science is somehow above politics. And this leaves us, I think, ill-prepared to cover scientific controversy. Making matters worse, science journalism suffers from an acute authority problem. And I think that has a lot to do with the way we, or how poorly we cover these kind of issues. In a sense, science journalism today is at the point where political journalism was 30 years ago, pre-Watergate. Back then, when a political reporter wanted to know what was going on in government, he would simply ask a government official what was news, and the government official would tell him. And it was usually a him in those days. Journalists seldom decided the news on their own. Political journalism was essentially licensed by government. So how do mere journalists and editors, who know much less about science than they think they know about politics, decide what is newsworthy and important in science? Well, the dirty secret is we don't. More often than not, we let the most prestigious peer-reviewed scientific journals, Nature, Science, Lancet, New England Journal of Medicine, decide for us to essentially license our journalism. If they publish something, it must be important and true. This makes our job pretty easy, actually, and allows us to maintain our faith in a scientific enterprise floating above the dirty world of politics and money. But what happens when one of those Olympian journals we rely on decides to unpublish something? Or when the scientist with the controversial discovery is suddenly fired, or denied tenure, or publicly attacked? Well, we journalists get completely flummoxed. Does this mean the controversial discovery is no longer true? That the peer review process, the supposed gold standard, was really just tin? Suddenly, we don't know whom to believe or where to turn for the truth. We certainly can't assess the science on our own. We don't know enough. And so, faced with viciously competing versions of the truth, we fall silent and decide to concentrate instead on the latest diet. Now, why should anyone outside journalism care about this state of affairs? Well, because in such an information environment, the powerful interests challenged by a troublesome discovery can discredit that discovery simply by muddying the waters. With media attacks, retractions, firings, the very sorts of attacks that would actually bring more attention to dissent in the political pages of the newspaper usually bring only silence in the science sections. And this, I think, is a grievous loss for all of us, because it means there is no longer any need or pressure for the offended industry or interest to actually disprove the troublesome discovery scientifically, which is how we all learned in school the system is supposed to work. The answer to allegedly flawed science is supposed to be more science, not attack followed by silence. Now, the four scientists on our panel tonight have been courageous enough to go public about the suppression of their science. It is truly an occasion to have them all together in, well, almost one room, two rooms. All of them have made important and troublesome discoveries, and all have found plenty of trouble as a result. Their discoveries, published in some of the most prestigious peer-reviewed journals, raise serious questions about the environmental and health implications of the powerful technologies at the heart of industrial agriculture. Now, at the risk of offending all of them in one fell swoop, I'd like now to introduce our panel, who I think of as the Dixie Chicks of the life sciences. Arpad Pusztai is a biochemist and an internationally recognized authority on nutrition with more than 300 published articles to his credit. He was the principal scientific officer at the Rowett Institute in Scotland, where he worked on designing experiments to assess the safety of genetically modified food. His troubles began in 1999 when he discovered that feeding a certain type of genetically modified potato to rodents damaged their health. His research was suppressed and he was forced to retire. Joseph Losey, who joins us from Ithaca, is an entomologist and an associate professor at Cornell. Losey's lab studies the impact of genetically engineered BT corn on both target and non-target insects. His troubles began with the discovery, also in 1999, I think, that when monarch butterflies were fed milkweed leaves dusted with pollen from these plants, they sickened and died. The industry launched a campaign to discredit his work. Tyrone Hayes is Associate Professor of Integrative Biology here at Berkeley. He is an internationally recognized expert on frogs. His trouble began also in the dark year for American science, 1999, when he was hired to assess the environmental impact of atrazine, a widely used herbicide, by a company working for its manufacturer, Syngenta. He discovered that even small exposures to atrazine, as little as one part in a billion, interfered with the sexual development of frogs, turning males into hermaphrodites. Efforts were made to suppress, delay, and discredit his work. Ignacio Chapella is a microbial ecologist and an assistant professor of ecosystem science, also here at Berkeley. His troubles began in 2001 when he and David Quist discovered that transgenes from genetically modified corn had found their way or introgressed into traditional maize land races in southern Mexico, the species center of diversity. The industry launched an international campaign to discredit him and his work. And finally, allow me to introduce and then turn things over to our moderator, Mark Dowie. Mark is an award-winning investigative journalist who writes about technology and the environment. He's published 2 books and won 4 national magazine awards and served as both editor and publisher of Mother Jones magazine. I suspect his duties here tonight are going to prove the perfect preparation for the course he's teaching at the Journalism School this spring, How to Cover Scientific Controversy. So will you please welcome our panel and Mark Dowie.
My job is to set the ground rules for this evening. Before I do, I want to emphasize a couple of things that Michael said that it makes me very, actually very proud to be up here amongst 4 of my heroes in life.
Can you hear me? Now, okay. Okay. These gentlemen are not here because their science has been challenged, although it has been challenged. All science is challenged. Almost every experiment that ever been done is challenged by someone else in the field. That's the nature of science. And if tenure depended on unchallenged science, there wouldn't be any tenured professors in the world. They all go through it. No, these scientists are here because they challenged the catechism of a very powerful industry, the handmaiden of industrial agriculture, and the darling of venture capital. The next big thing, as the venture capitalists like to call it, biotechnology. Very sacred cow here in the university and everywhere where these gentlemen work. Their experiments were all reported, as Michael said, in peer-reviewed journals, and they had an immediate economic effect. I think it's important to emphasize that the effect that got these guys in trouble was not the scientific effect, it was the economic effect or the potential economic effect of their findings. That's why they're here, meeting together for the first time and to carry on a conversation, exchange their experience, and discuss the consequences before a live and global audience, as it turns out. So we're gonna try to keep this to 2 hours. From the very beginning, including Michael's introductions. It is a live webcast, and it's reaching Mexico, and Europe should be about ready to get up now, so there'll be some Europeans watching it as well, and who knows, in the Far East, potentially everywhere in the world. There are cards. I don't know whether you've been given cards or picked up cards. There are cards for questions. Whenever you have a question, just write it on the card. You can identify yourself if you want. On the card, you don't have to. And there are 5 brilliant post-grad students here who will come and pick up your cards. They will process the cards, and there will also questions coming back off the webcast through the internet. So we'll be getting questions coming through that door as well. So, and we'll accumulate the questions, and in the second hour, we'll give the questions to the panelists as they're processed. I'm going to ask each of the panelists to just give a 3-minute statement. They can say anything they want. And then we have asked each panelist to bring a question to the panel for another panelist. And hopefully that will begin the conversation that will be the most stimulating part of the evening. I'll be processing the cards, and I will be trying to keep people brief on the panel. And then when we do the questions, I will be fielding the questions in the second half of the meeting. So, there we go. Who's going to start?
Well, it's up to you. You
no, you start. You start.
You are the moderator. Well, we all have to follow what you say.
Microphone.
The mic. There is no mic.
Oh, it's here.
It's behind you. It's on your chair.
Oh.
Oh, I see. Very, very good. Can you hear me now? Well, I am Arpad Pusztai. I used to be a very conventional scientist. I did my work, wrote a paper, published it, and nothing actually prepared me for what followed after my very simple announcement in 1998. This was a little television broadcast, 150 seconds of it, 12 sentences, in which because our money for the research which we did came from the British taxpayers, including myself, I thought that it was quite right for me to report back to them that what is the potential problem with GM food. We did a research which cost $3 million equivalent to the British taxpayer, and we found that there were some worrying developments. We had this genetically modified potato, which we fed as a substitute to rats, and we did get some worrying effects. In the long term, the genetically modified potatoes, even when they were fully cooked, did not support the growth of the rats. These were young rats. Now, you know that you can't do any experiments with children. So they were standing in for children. And we found that there were some problems, and we couldn't explain that. Then the next thing was that because young rats developed their own immune system, their endocrine system, their bacteria flora, they are in a sort of transition before they become adults. And we found that when we are feeding these rats with genetically modified potatoes, their immune system slowed down. It was not developing so well. They were, their organs, their guts, their pancreas, their liver were not developing as well as the ones which had been fed on the parent line, non-genetically modified potatoes. So we were really perplexed. Quite truly, I tell you that I was very perplexed, because we have taken the gene and the gene product after 6.5 years of studies for not seeing the things which we were seeing. And we couldn't understand it. And then we did some critical experiment which had drawn the attention, our attention, and probably even more importantly, the biotech industry's attention to the fact that insertion into the genome did cause some unpredictable changes with potentially harmful consequences. Now, the whole thing, I just, as I say, simple scientist, I reported these facts to my peers, which were the British taxpayers, and told them there are problems. And I don't see corresponding effort to clear up these problems. And that worried me even more. So I naively reported this to the British public, and the consequence of that was really quite unbelievable. I never thought that as a conventional scientist I would have reporters parking and living on my drive-in to try to get my views on anything. I'm a very polite and humble person that I couldn't really understand that, how this happened, till somebody explained to me that what I put my foot in was a multi-billion dollar business. Now, that has never really came to my mind. I'd reported something which was science, and there were all these implications. So I leave this to you to ponder on, that how does a straightforward, simple scientist get into this field of major international controversy? And perhaps you are better equipped to deal with it than I was. Perhaps the rest of the panel is better equipped to deal with it, but I leave it to you. Thank you.
Tyrone.
My name is Tyrone. Am I on?
Yes, you're on.
And I have to say the one thing that we certainly have in common is that I was very naive in the sense that I was asked by a company to evaluate a chemical, and I, at the time, certainly didn't think about the implications or about the compound, or it was just simple science that I was getting into. I study amphibian developmental endocrinology, which means I'm interested in the role of hormones in frog development, and in particular, the role of sex hormones, testosterone and estrogen, the same hormones that are important in human sexual development, as well as thyroid hormone, another hormone important in growth and neural development. And I was, in part, encouraged by the university to develop one of our models as a test, one of our amphibian models, as sort of a test for example, compounds that might induce breast cancer. So we were studying estrogens that might induce breast cancer. And as part of filing a patent, you are encouraged to show efficacy, that if the university invests in your intellectual property, that you know, there's the possibility that it will bring in money. And it did, in fact. I ended up consulting for Novartis, which then became Syngenta, and they asked me to evaluate a compound, atrazine, an herbicide, that, again, I was very naive. It turns out it's the number one herbicide used in the world on the U.S.'s number one crop. It's primarily used on corn. We tested the compound, and we found that this compound, atrazine, caused male frogs to develop female characteristics. Male frogs would develop ovaries and, in some case, would develop eggs in their testes. And would also chemically castrate or demasculinize exposed males. Their testosterone would go away, and they would start to make estrogen. I reported this to the company, to Syngenta, to EcoRisk, which was the consulting company working for Syngenta at the time. And what they encouraged me to do was to repeat the work and to continue to repeat the work at a slower pace. And I should point out that I wasn't, and still am not, opposed to repeating the work. It was a very surprising result. Very low doses, actually a tenth of what was reported here, 0.1 parts per billion. And it was a dose that, you know, is 30 times lower than what's allowed in drinking water for humans. It also turned out that the company was aware of publications that had shown the same mechanism, the conversion of testosterone to estrogen, had been reported in mammals, including human cell lines, and that there were data suggesting that atrazine, through the same mechanism potentially, might be involved in increased breast cancer and induced mammary cancers, or as they put it, earlier onset of mammary cancers in rats, and was associated with an increase in prostate cancers in their own factories, again, through what we're calling endocrine disruption potentially. I eventually resigned from working with Syngenta and EcoRisk, in part because of the ways that they had tried to slow the work, in my opinion, suppress the work. And I did repeat the work on my own without their funding. I was then approached by November of 2000. I was approached by Syngenta again with an offer that I should make a proposal to Syngenta to get involved with them in the research again. And my response was, how can I make a proposal for work that I've already done on my own money? Essentially, they tried to purchase the work that I had already done. And I did not think about that at all. I assure you, I refused to do it. Their next... their next approach was to request a meeting here at Berkeley, alone with me. And I invited instead my students, from graduate students, undergraduates, my dean, my chair, as many people as I could. But they proceeded with their efforts to discredit my work. They presented, they brought in a statistician who claimed that there were errors and that my students had made errors, etc., and I asked them to leave at that point. So I repeated the work, and when I published it, and I just did it. I did what my older peers that I looked up to told me to do. Just do the science, stick to the science, and stay out of the politics. So I did just that. I didn't say a word. And when I completed the work, I published it in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And then I was contacted by the Environmental Protection Agency. And again, after I published a second paper showing that this effect occurred in the wild, a paper that I published in Nature, I was again contacted by the Environmental Protection Agency, which was sort of my second piece of surprise. They repeatedly, including over email, warned me not to provoke the company, that the company was big and that they would attempt to destroy my career. These are things that the EPA warned me about. But we continued to publish the work, and the company then continued to hire multiple scientists who would present themselves as independent scientists from University of Florida, from Michigan State, from a number of universities, who would do things like, for example, repeat the work but not care for the animals, so 90% of the animals would die, and so they would claim that they didn't repeat our work, things like that. And I think one of the biggest losses in that is that they were often hiring students to repeat that work. So some of the people that they hired to quote-unquote repeat my work were students getting their PhD. Some of the students, such as one at University of Florida, managed to get out of the situation and start her career over. Others finished having just repeated my work and repeated it very poorly. One of the other discouraging things is I discovered in the middle of this all, I was asked to review a proposal by a major company that does, you know, some bioscreening and testing, a company called Battelle Laboratories, I guess. Can I name names? Somehow, somebody didn't pay attention, and I was asked to review the proposal, which turned out to be verbatim, word for word, my work plagiarized out of copyrighted published books. And so I approached the EPA about this. This was a company that the Environmental Protection Agency was making a contract with who will do this kind of amphibian work. And I approached them with it, and their offer to me was, what if we contract some of the work to you? My response was, wait, you've stolen my car, and now you're asking if it's okay if you let me borrow it on the weekend. When I brought this up to the Environmental Protection Agency and said, if I catch my students in my classroom plagiarizing, they would get kicked out of school. The reply from the Environmental Protection Agency was, the rules that operate in the ivory tower do not function in the real world. And the other thing that was disappointing to me was that the company completely denied having seen my data when it became public. And when I reported to the EPA and said, look, I have the Federal Express receipts of when I sent the data to them, instead of being prosecuted for not turning in data regarding adverse effects, there's a law against that, the EPA allowed them to revise their story. And the company revised their story saying, well, we saw the report, but we never saw the raw data. And then when I faxed a copy of my raw data with their handwriting on it, the EPA then sent me another email and said, well, this is an offense, and they're going to be prosecuted for it. And then a couple days later, I received an email that the company had surprisingly arranged a meeting across the street from the EPA, and that was the last I heard of the case. Anyway, I'll stop there with my series of disappointments. And
All right, we're keeping John Losey up late in Ithaca, are you, John?
Yeah.
So why don't you go next?
Okay, thank you, and I'd like to thank Ignacio and the other organizers for inviting me to be here, in a sense. And I just wanted to echo the sentiments of not being prepared for what happened when I published my work. I'd only been on the job for about a year and a half when I first started this project, and actually wasn't what I ended up publishing on was on some non-target effects of BT corn, which is a transgenic, genetically modified strain of corn. But it's not what I started out looking at. I started out looking and thinking more about resistance and that the target pest becoming resistant to that corn. But what we found when we were out in the field, some of my students and I, is that if you go out among BT corn fields, and we were looking for weeds that were around those fields, that those weeds got dusted with the BT corn pollen. And so I started to wonder, knowing that the toxin is expressed in the pollen, which is a mobile, the only mobile form of the plant tissue, what would happen if that BT pollen was dusted on milkweeds, which we saw that it was out in the field. So we brought some milkweed leaves in, we dusted some with the BT pollen, we dusted some with non-BT pollen, and we left some undusted. And what we found was, surprisingly, that when the monarch larva, the caterpillars, ate the leaves that were dusted with the BT pollen, about half of those died after 4 days. But when they ate either the non-BT pollen or the leaves without pollen, none of those caterpillars died. And what was surprising about that is that there had essentially been no research other than the target pests and a few other pest species that had been looked at before this corn was released out into the environment. And so I did that work. I shared it with a large group of my peers that work on corn. I actually shared it with both Novartis and what was then Novartis and Monsanto. And it's just interesting, and I guess this is part of the reason for this forum. We also had they requested a meeting here at Cornell. And so they came and suggested some different wording in the paper. In fact, they people from Novartis pretty much came out and said, we'd really rather you didn't publish this. You should go back and get more data. And my thought at the time was that this corn was already out on over 20 million acres. And the time for getting more data was 5 years ago before it was released. And now was the time to... We didn't have a definitive answer, and in fact, I don't think we still have a definitive answer on the effects of pollen on these other butterflies, but if we sat on it another year longer, that would be another year that it was out there on 20 million acres having unknown effects. And so it, in my mind, it was definitely the time to put it out for the public and my peers, and after it's been almost 5 years since that happened, and there's been a couple of dozen labs that have worked on that, and we still don't really know the sort of long-term subtle effects that the pollen might have on these populations. And not only do we sort of have a partial answer for monarch butterflies, we know there's not going to be a catastrophic effect on those, but some of the other work we've done shows that there's almost 200 species of butterflies and moths that live in and around corn. And so we don't have a final answer for the long term on the monarch, and we don't really have any data for any of these other 200 species. And that's, I think, what's a little disconcerting. In terms of my own experience and what happened with my work after it was published, the maelstrom of press that surrounded the publication of the article was just like nothing I've ever seen before, and I had never dealt with the press before that happened, and so it was overwhelming, and certainly there were a lot of industry folks that were trying to denigrate what we found or put it in a light that would make it seem like it's not important. And one of the most interesting things that I found was that I didn't just get it from the industry side. What I felt like was happening, and what apparently is a fairly common phenomenon, is that we published a very well-defined one-page paper with some data on what happened in the lab, and didn't really speculate on what would happen in populations in the field, other than saying that we needed more research. A lot of environmental groups extended what we said in our sort of carefully worded data from what we found in the lab to say that, well, this may have grave implications, could cause monarchs are going to go extinct, and so are all these other butterflies. And then the industry groups are shooting at me for saying that monarchs are going to go extinct, even though I never really said that. So it's sort of this idea of building a straw man and shooting at scientists for things that they didn't say. And it seems like that's happened in Ignacio's case too. It would be interesting to have him comment on that. This idea of sort of building the straw man and then cutting that down and not cutting down the scientists' own work. The last thing that I wanted to say was that I think this whole idea of trying to denigrate or humiliate publicly some of the scientists that do the work, I don't think is new. And I in fact, though, I wanted to read a quote about one of the four panelists, and see if the audience or maybe one of the panelists will know which one of our works this was written about. It says that the publisher might want to reconsider its plans to publish this piece, especially in view of the inaccurate and disparaging statements about our products. And I don't know if anybody has an idea of which one of our works that was actually said about.
Could be anybody.
It could be. Actually, it's a...
You know? It's probably Tyrone.
I don't know.
What this is that... What was the answer?
Tyrone Hayes.
Actually, it's a trick question. The answer is none of the above. This was written about Rachel Carson. And when she published Silent Spring in 1962. But what I thought was interesting is that it's exactly the same tone as what's written about. And if you look back at the people that first tried to sound the alarm about cigarettes, about the ozone layer, I think you would see very similar things. So I think the idea is not new. And if I could just, the very last thing then that I wanted to finish with is, I think once there's all these things that set up these controversies, and one of the things is that us as researchers, we stand a better chance of getting research money if we go after the hot topics. And in a sense, we have to, in some ways, research what's hot, and what's hot tends to be what's controversial. And so we sort of start the ball rolling, and then if we publish things that go and do say something that looks smacks of being negative to the industry, then it's in their best interest to publicly humiliate us and make it look like those results aren't important or are somehow flawed. And then those statements between us, between the researchers and the companies, those sort of flames of controversy, I think, are fanned by environmental groups and the press. And I'm not trying to denigrate any of these groups, certainly not the researchers or the press or environmental groups. But once that sort of polarization starts, I think we stop making progress. And we've made a lot of progress since Rachel Carson's day. I mean, my background is actually in pest management, and what I would say is we've made a lot of progress since Rachel Carson's day in terms of the pesticides that we use today are much less environmentally harmful than the ones back in 1962. And I think if we can start to have negative results as well as positive results respected, then we can start to have some really constructive dialogue, and then we can really see if maybe some of these genetically modified organisms, transgenic plants, are going to actually be an environmentally sound option. But we can't really get to that point. We can't start making progress until we can sort of get past the battle lines. And so I guess I'm sort of hoping that maybe this sort of dialogue that we're having now and seeing what's gone on in the recent past can lead us to how we can be more constructive in the future. Thanks.
I just wanted to acknowledge the people who might be watching, who are, I think, are watching if the webcasting is working, and thank them all for being here. This is, hello? If they pull the plug on us, which has happened in the past, we've been very careful to try and avoid that. I'm going to try to not talk too much about the specifics of our work, my work, but rather to try and transcend that a little bit. I guess that's maybe because I feel that I'm different. I was not naive when I got into this. I was kind of prepared. I'm a mutt, you know. I'm an academic mutt. I've worked for industry. I've worked for international organizations. I've worked for NGOs. I've worked for indigenous communities in different parts, especially in Latin America. And it was with that background that I ended up in this place that is called the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management. The guys recruited me and hired me, and I was really elated because this is a place where people are actually proposing that you can do science and you can do serious thinking about that higher level of problems, the politics, that politics are part of science, that policy is something that we can think rationally about. Little did I know, I mean, I took it seriously, and it's been 7 years of a really very interesting time, but within the first year, I was already dealing with the realities of working in the academic world, and the fact that I was being recruited as the chairman of the whole faculty for my college, 120 faculty members, and within less than a month of my tenure of that, I was presented with the reality that we were about to sign a $50 million agreement with Novartis. It turns out that I had worked for Novartis. I had worked for Sandoz before it became Novartis. So I was not naive. I just knew too much about it. And it was clear to me that the idea there was, not in the department, but in the higher at the higher levels in the on campus, was that I should have been naive, that I should have been young, and I should have been scared, junior as I was. So I had about half an hour to decide: am I going to act my role as a naive, young, new hire, looking forward to tenure, or am I going to act my knowledge, which came from all that mud experience, from that experience working with industry and so on. I, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, I'm very happy that I did, decided for the second. And I said, I don't think so. I've looked at this from inside the industry, and I know what this is about. And I think that our faculty would have something to say about it if they only knew. Because it turns out that they didn't know. That was the beginning of the problem for me. Problem. I wouldn't call it a problem. I would call it the adventure, really, here at Berkeley. The adventure had a very, very interesting peak that I think people mostly in England, who are looking, not so much people in the Bay Area, because there's a lot of suppression of media information in the U.S. about this, but in Europe there's a lot of coverage. We'll know the details of the research that David Quist, who is sitting right here, and myself did, showing that there was a movement of transgenic genes from industrial crops somewhere, probably in the U.S., into the land races of corn in Mexico, which is the cradle of corn and the repository of genetic diversity of corn for the world. A very serious development. And that was the one, too, I think, in my case, that has taken me into this adventure. The adventure has a very high peak. This is a very important moment for me. There is an article that is published tomorrow. That is published tomorrow. It's dated tomorrow, so the people who are watching from abroad, especially when you go east far enough, it's today for you. It's coming out in Nature, and it says, Berkeley accused of biotech bias as ecologist is denied tenure. So my tenure has just been denied a few days ago, so that kind of makes this a very interesting kind of closure of a cycle for me here. An adventure, part of an adventure. It's part of what I believe a very tragic historical development. And it's not about me, I think. It's not about that specific. I really would like to stay away from that. It is a historical development that's happening right in front of our eyes that I think has two very important things. One is that we're watching drying in the vine, the dying of an extraordinary domain of human inquiry, something that we used to call biology. A natural science, a natural philosophy, a way of looking at the world that is being narrowed, channeled down to just one way of looking at the world that I think is not going to give us too many answers for the questions that we had at the beginning. And the second is that we are watching right before our eyes, right here in this space, we're watching the loss of an intellectual commons, a public sphere that used to be, that has been paid by the public for many, many years, for generations, to build these brick-and-mortar walls. I'm very happy to deal with virtual worlds and so on, but we need these labs, we need these pipes, we need this glassware and so on to run experiments. And the public has worked hard at getting this, at securing this, and we're watching it disappear. So to me, those are the two tragedies. I have two very basic agendas. One is to try and save biology from the fate of physics, the nuclear industry came to be. At this point, you cannot really be a reliable physicist unless you work in that very specific field of science, where physics was a very broad field, now it's very narrow. Where biology used to be a very broad field, now it's very, very narrow, and I believe that is my agenda. Biology is different from physics, and biotechnology, genetic engineering is different from manipulating nuclear power. There is no need for centralization. There is no need for doing things behind closed doors. There is no need for secrecy. Yet we have it, and it's really, really eating away at that public intellectual commons. The question of how does it happen, which I think many of you might be interested in, the details of our, you know, painful or not painful personal lives and details and so on, they are important. We are people and we're individuals. It's important histories. But I think the question of how did we get here is a really important one. How is it that an institution could be hijacked so easily? Because I really believe that that institution, that ship of truth-seeking that is the academic, especially the public university, you know, this is such a jewel of a university, that ship is being looted and pirated left and right. And we're watching it, we're seeing it being done. And the question is this a ship that's adrift, that just went adrift and went in its way, and then now it's caught in the hands of the pirates and so on? And, you know, when I say pirates, I cannot avoid coming to real examples, and I just want to quote one, very simple one. This is our ex-dean of the School of Public Policy, Penhoet, who was also a CEO of a biotech company and probably was hired for that reason to take the deanship of that place. And I'm just quoting from a recent quote of his that says, I think that industry, with more than 4,000 companies, and now all the pharma companies, have done an extraordinary job of extracting all the value from the basic science that gets conducted in universities funded by NIH. And the notion that there is a lot of extremely valuable science left untapped in this country and that needs somehow an outlet different from the biotech companies seems to me simply incorrect. That means we have done a very good job at extracting all the value. The university is only about making value, and let's make no mistake, this is monetary value, right? And we have done a very good job of extracting it. Now, you know, just we're left with the empty bagasse of that university. This is the looting, this is the pirating that I'm referring to. So is this ship adrift so that it's exposed to this pirating? Is it just broken down, that it needs a few bolts and nuts fixed here or there? And I would claim, in my 3 minutes remarks, that I would claim that it's not really that. I would claim that this is a ship that has been purposefully and consciously captained and steered into the shoals to be pirated, where it can be pirated. I would posit, and I know that this is uncomfortable for many of us, that we have been too much of a willing crew. I think it's really easy to go after Novartis and after Monsanto, and I think we should go after them because they deserve it. But I also believe that there is a political, there is a cultural opportunity that we give, that we make possible for them to take that opportunity. So I would say it's not Monsanto, it's not Novartis that took my tenure away. It's us. There's something intrinsic in the institution that we really need to think about. We're not clueless. It's very simple, very easy for many people. Often people in the community around Berkeley love to hate the university and love to hate scientists and love to hate us. And it's very easy for them to say, well, they're clueless. They don't know what they're talking about. They have no idea about the world. It's not true. If there's one thing you can say about us, is that there is at least a very good amount of intelligence here. The question is, what are we using that intelligence for? And where is the bridle? And where is the rudder of this ship that has gone adrift? One of the many microphones that we have around is of Maria Gagliardi, who has a radio that is called TUC Radio. And she told me the other day what that TUC stands for. It was always a mystery for me. And it stands for Time of Useful Consciousness. And apparently it's a term from the Navy, where you're riding your fighter plane. You're going so fast that you can pass out. But there is that very small instant of consciousness where you can do something to save your life. And I really love that idea, apart from the fact that these three words, Maria, are so beautiful, time of useful consciousness, because I think it describes a lot the moment that we're living today and what you guys are seeing here in front of you. It's the opportunity, a window into that time of useful consciousness, that moment of opportunity where we can do something to save ourselves and to save this incredibly wonderful institution that so many people have worked for. So I invite you to be engaged. I invite you to... we are keeping the website open, and we hope that this will become a much broader conversation into the future. The webcast, unless they pull the plug on us, should be up for people to watch for months to come. And we'll be dealing as well as possible with your input. So all the people who are sending messages right now in your cards here in the live audience or through the email just outside, please don't give up on us because you didn't hear your questions fielded. We will deal with them as best as we can. Thank you.
Ignacio. Get the questions now. Start collecting questions. Very good. If anyone has questions prepared, if hold them up, our students will come and pick them up. And if any have come in over the internet, somebody can bring them through the door. While that's happening, perhaps members of the panel would like to ask a question of another member of the panel. Anybody got anything in mind? Tyrone, you?
Councilman Hero, you mentioned you might have a question. Or John?
I would have a question.
Go ahead.
One of the problems which we had to face in the UK was how to deal with alleged wrongdoing in science. I mean, we have a mechanism for it in the UK. Maybe it's not very good, but there is a sort of accepted mechanism. That is that they set up an audit committee of independent scientists, senior scientists, who will look at the facts and will come to some sort of decision. That this certainly happened in my case, even though that the outcome was already decided even before the audit has started, and the results of it are probably reasonably well known. But I quite genuinely don't know if there is a similar type of mechanism in the U.S. If you are accused of doing something which is fabricating your results or changing the emphasis or whatever, is there a mechanism to deal with it?
Only for government-funded research.
What about universities?
Only if it's funded by the government.
But you can still destroy the reputation of a university scientist, regardless where he gets his money from, because it's his future and, in a sense, the future of science is at stake. I mean, this is something very, very serious. It cannot be related just simply to where the money comes for the research. But you see that if we make a dissent destroyed at this stage, regardless where the money comes for, I mean, what does it say about science, and what does it say about society?
In my own case might be a little bit unique because my work was available. It was peer-reviewed, proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and then the industry reported that they had tried to repeat the work and got a different result, but that work at the time wasn't available. They reported this in the press. The Environmental Protection Agency then made arrangements as far as developed an agenda and invited people to come in, and we would all get together and present our work to the EPA, and it would be evaluated by scientists chosen by the EPA. And as I told you, instead of that meeting happening, in fact, I would have had to pay out of pocket to go to Washington, D.C. and present my work. Instead of that meeting happening, the industry then held a private meeting with the EPA across the street, and then the next week the EPA flew up to their headquarters, the company's headquarters, and then it went away. And then the EPA visited me separately. In addition, in terms of reporting my work to the EPA, there's a specific law called 6A2 that requires that companies report within some time frame adverse effects. And instead of acting on that law, instead of prosecuting the company, in this case Syngenta, for not presenting that work in the amount of time that they were, they allowed them to change their story over and over and over again. You know, it's like having a law against shoplifting, but then saying, okay, if you put it back, then we'll let you slide. I mean, that's essentially what happened in my case.
But you are you were not given a proper chance to present your views. At least in the UK, eventually the UK Parliament gave me the right, regardless whether it was good or bad, to present my case. When is it that, what does it say about society and about democracy? If you are the individual who's done the work is not given a chance to defend it in public. Now, you make no mistake about it. I grew up under the Nazis and then under the communists. But my self-defense was never taken away from me. Only in the UK for 7 months, I was not allowed to defend myself. Now, what does it say about that society? This is supposed to be the mother country of democracy. You came all from it. You derived from it. So what does it say? Now, it doesn't say a great deal to me, I think that's why we're all here, that this message must come out, that any society which suppresses the individual scientist and anything which is uncomfortable to listen to is ultimately cutting its own throat. So you have to reflect on that.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I had a very similar experience to Tyrone's, in the sense that after the paper was published on the potential effect on the monarch butterflies, the EPA did what they call a data call-in. And what it was is they asked for more data on what would happen to not only monarchs but other non-target butterflies. And so that, I think, was, they did it fairly quickly. They actually got all of the researchers together along with the companies and some environmental groups, including notably the Union of Concerned Scientists, and we all sort of got together and decided what the priorities should be for this research to go forward. And I think that part was really positive. What I think, and I'd be interested in other people's comments on this, what's not necessarily going in the right direction, I think, is when they put out that data call-in, similar to the data they collect for initial registration, all that data comes from the companies. And so it's always seemed to me a little bit like the fox guarding the hen house, in the sense that what does the EPA base its decision on for registration? It bases it on data developed by the companies that want to get the product registered. And there's just, even for people of high intelligence and goodwill and being completely above board, that just inherently sets up a conflict, I think. And I'd just be interested to hear if other people think so and what maybe the solution is. I have an idea for a solution, but I'd just be interested to hear what the other panelists think.
I just wanted to say that, yes, I think that's absolutely right. We know I worked for a while on a committee for the National Academy looking at the scientific basis for the regulation of transgenic plants. And it's obvious that the regulatory system is totally overwhelmed. And so often I feel a lot of sympathy for my colleagues and friends sometimes within the regulatory system who are just overwhelmed. And are actually instructed to look the other way, actually instructed to not consider the right, for example, the right field of inquiry. What ARPAD, I think, has shown is that the right field of inquiry to look at those potatoes was toxicology, histology, embryology, that type of thing. And the regulators are instructed to look the other way. Now the question is why? And again, we can just hit our heads against the wall a lot if we do not understand this as a historical development. There was a very clear decision almost a quarter century ago to to just instruct the regulatory agencies to look the other way. We needed a replacement technology for computers, informatic technology, and so on, when we knew it was going to go to shores of lower environmental and labor standards. And back then, you know, it was Dan Quayle's Committee on Competitiveness made a very clear, bright-eyed, and some people could say a very legitimate and necessary decision to say we need to promote this technology as the replacement technology for the future. So it was back then that that decision was made, and it's that decision that our friends within the regulatory agencies are struggling with, because they're totally underpowered, because the whole house has been set, the structure of it has been set against them, not to speak against us.
I still don't know if you have a mechanism. At least on paper we have one, but I didn't have a chance. They were just telling us, please send down your data. We'll sit in judgment of you, and we'll let you know what our decision is. Now, that is, I better not say anything what I think of that.
Does anyone else on the panel have a question? Do you have a question of anyone on the panel, Tyrone?
I'd like to ask the panel, in your own cases, what do you think the responsibility of your institutions were? In other words, what should have been done different? What could have been done differently?
Well, I say that in my case, my institution, my director, who was sort of going for a big job, when he had the political pressure on him, he just simply decided that his future is much bigger than my future is, so he sacrificed me on the altar of his future. This actually happened, although he had almost exactly the same opinion as I had, but he was a political beast and I wasn't. I thought that science and what I grew up in and what I believed in was far more important than future for individual future. He obviously disagreed with me.
Do you have an answer to that question?
Yeah. Again, I think you think of the structures, you think of the history, and there is a long history that's difficult to go against in the structures. The structures really react in very predictable ways. But I think, referring to the two previous questions, my personal experience in this adventure was that we actually were able to go to Sacramento. And we have people from the legislature in this audience. We do have, we are supposed to have, a system of accountability. You know, this is not the University of Novartis. This is the University of California. And, you know, it's as though I come to, you know, Mark, I went to your office the other day, and I said, it's as if I came to your office and I bought a computer for you, and then I said, well, the office is mine, plus all your writing. So, but we seem to forget that we are actually accountable to somebody. Those people are also sleeping at the wheel. You know, I'm sorry, those people from the legislature here, but the system is there, and the question is, do we use it? Do we force the situation so that the system has to be used, and that we hold the fire, you know, their feet to the fire there? Just as I feel we are holding the feet to the fire of our colleagues in the scientific environment right now.
John, did you have an answer to Tyrone's question?
Yeah, in terms of how I was dealt with or treated within my own academic unit, my experience actually was really positive, and I think maybe that might differ from some of the others in the sense that my department of entomology here at Cornell was very supportive from the beginning of the work. there were a few notable people in other parts of Cornell that publicly really came out against it. Those people weren't necessarily that well liked in my department, so that worked out well for me. And I was supported from the beginning, and I was given tenure, which is sort of a vote of confidence of my peers here, and so I can't really fault them for that. And one thing I think that's, and it's in some ways true of where you are too, is that Cornell is a center for development of a lot of the transgenics and the GMOs. It's been a leader in that area, and I think there may be some political value in having someone and now a group of people that work on looking at some of the ecological impacts of that. So then you've sort of got both sides represented, and so I guess in general I think I've been treated fairly well.
Could I just say a disclaimer to join John in case I gave the wrong impression? The Department of Environmental Science Policy and Management recruited me, actively hired me, and it seems from the show of presence in this audience again that they seem convinced, they seem stubborn that they made the right choice. It's more interesting than that. It's not just that the people who watch you work, the people who watch you teach, the people that you deal on an everyday tend to be, at least in my case, have been incredibly supportive. The vote in my faculty was 32-1 mm-hmm. of the people who actually know what I'm doing. And it was only when you reach to the higher levels, number one, that can act unaccountably, and number two, that can be influenced by, you know, the other side of the coin, that the case was totally turned around. So John, I totally agree with you that there is, I think, a sense of camaraderie, a sense of a cohesiveness within the colleagues in the scientific community, yet that is overridden by this transformed structure that we have had, this engineering of the institution that we have been watching for the last quarter century.
Yeah, and I think what's too bad about that is it's not only that the people within your own unit are your comrades, but they're also probably the professionals that are best able to really evaluate the technical details of what you've done. And so if you start getting overturned further down the line, you're being overturned by somebody who you're overturning a vote of 32-1 by somebody who really doesn't understand the science as well as those 33 people, and I think that's a problem.
Here is my question for anyone in the panel. As a society now, we're trying very hard to minimize the influence of money over politics. And there was a Supreme Court ruling today in our favor, a lot of people of goodwill are working on that problem. Should we not be thinking about ways to remove the influence of money over science? And I was wondering whether any of you had any thoughts about that, whether there are ways now that we could, similar to the way the politicians are limiting their. John, sounds like you have an answer. John? Can you get John on? Thank you. We've lost John. Okay. Wait, anyone else on the panel while we're getting John hooked up? We're not hearing you, John. Well, doesn't anyone else on the panel have thoughts about money and science?
Is utopia?
I'm a utopian.
Yes. You're probably just as much of an optimist and looking forward to
some sort of return of sanity in this business. I'm afraid I have no real solution for the problem, but it is someone who is old enough, who still remembers of what we now call the golden age of science, certainly in England, during the 60s and the early 70s, where there was practically no influence of commercial money into the business of biology. Now that we certainly regard as the golden age of biological sciences, I don't know how to get back to it, but it has to be done. It has to be done somehow, because we are going to end up with a lot of, I don't know, I don't want to be very unkind to some of the commercial science which we have developed in the last 20 years, but it is going to be something which is going to lead up that proverbial garden path. And maybe there will be a lot of products which then will be thrown out in no time whatsoever. I can't really think how we got into this situation. I know the people will tell me and I will understand it. Nevertheless, I had a huge respect for my colleagues. And when I look at them, they have gone in a direction which probably as an old scientist, a sort of clapped out old scientist who's been put out on green pastures. I don't really understand. I do understand in one sense, but I don't understand in another. But please, all these clever people, come up with some sort of answer very soon, because science will be lost. Biological science will be lost. We're going to end up with a lot of papers and products which are not worth the paper they are written on. So please, 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 all the economists and whatever, come and rescue us, because we got into a real jam and we must be rescued from it for all our sake.
I totally agree with that, but I think we have so many steps that could be so easily dealt with already. We're so deep in it, I believe. When, you know, yes, in my case, when the reality of conflict of interest is not even acknowledged, it's not even recognized that the people who are, you know, making decisions on where the money goes or making decisions on who stays or who goes, who gets hired, what type of student comes in, what type of research is done or not done, when those people have a very definite conflict of interest and we're not even paying attention to it, I mean, these are steps that really tell me we are very far down a line that we could backstep on it a long way, I think. If we were serious about really reviewing conflict of interest, I'm afraid that would have to go all the way from, I think, the chancellor down to the, you know, the lowest footman. But so what? We've lived like that before. And the fact that biology all of a sudden has the promise of making money is not, should not be a problem. I mean, I don't have anything to do against industry or against, you know, creating new things. But if you look at the situation, the way we have it, because of this conflict of interest, we're producing a technology that is actually not useful, that is actually not sellable. And we continue to stubbornly throw money, bad money, I mean good money after bad, on something that I think anybody who knows about the field knows that that it has gone way beyond the level of utility that it promised. And it has to do with conflict of interest, I believe. that we just cannot even call it. We cannot even call it by its name.
We're not going
to...
Oh, John.
Hello? Do you hear me?
Yeah.
Can I respond to that question about the money? I just wanted to relate in terms of a solution, one sort of brief, shining Camelot-like period that I think could be a good model for maybe how we could proceed. And that is after, for me, after the Monarch paper came out, and I alluded to this a little bit already, there were several meetings that I thought were very useful where we brought in scientists from all over the country that were interested in this issue. They brought in USDA folks. They brought in EPA folks, all the regulatory people. They brought in several environmental groups and all the industries that were involved in creating the transgenic crops. And from that meeting, we all came up with research priorities to look specifically at these does BT corn affect non-target butterflies? And industry put in money, and the USDA put in money, the EPA put in money, and then a panel, not the industry itself, but then a panel of all these different groups put out grant money based on, we all were able to apply for it, and they put it out. So instead of the model that normally happens, which is the EPA calls for data, the companies have the money, so they decide who does what, how it's published, whether it's published at all. Now you had the USDA administering the grants through this panel, and so there was no strings attached, and yet industry was putting in money for this risk assessment. And I think if the industry, if the money could go away from the industry and go to this sort of no strings attached model, and people, scientists could just do the work, which everybody agrees is what needs to be done, then it's a fairly simple change, it seems to me, and one that I think could really be effective. Unfortunately, as far as I know, that pool of money I know wasn't very big, and that model hasn't been followed after that. I mean, now they're back to the industry puts in the data, and they're doing it, most of it, in-house. And I just don't think, again, maybe a lot of it's good data, but most of it doesn't get peer-reviewed, and there's no sort of checks and balances on it.
As I was saying, there are so many terrific questions here, and we're not going to have time for all of them, but all of your questions are going to be put onto the website, so don't feel offended if we haven't chosen your question. I want to start with one that comes from Colgate University in Hamilton, New York, via the Internet. I'm just excited that there's someone across the country watching us and has a question. It's a good question. It's a devil's advocate question. Chris Henke says, though I'm sympathetic to the theme of the panel and the experiences of the panelists, I'd like to play devil's advocate. One early theme in the discussion is the suppression of controversial science. But is it appropriate to call most of these cases instances of suppression? Surely each panelist has faced intense pressure and criticism, but at the same time, their research has been published in some of the most prestigious science publications, much to the consternation of their critics. Isn't there something promising about the amount of publicity and public debate that have surrounded each panelist's research?
Data was never published or reported to the EPA the way it was supposed to. My data was published after I left and after I did the work out of pocket.
So. Thank you.
And I should point out that that also involves a lot of undergraduates working for no salary to repeat that work. So.
Maybe some good is coming from all of this.
The question is well understood and it's well taken. To me, the answer is count us with the fingers of your one hand. Where I think Michael was very right in saying I think behind each one of us four, who are, you're seeing as survivors, and, or some of us kind of half survivors, there is a mass of deceased persons, you know, of broken careers, of not even started careers that never got there. So I think that's what's interesting about this conversation, in my view, for myself, that I think this is. Our cases, I don't think, are unusual in any way, apart from the fact, like David Noble says, apart from the fact that you are seeing them. I personally have multiple experiences, and this is all anecdotal because it's only the few cases that come to me, of students who come and say, you know, that's why I didn't apply to graduate school, because I don't believe in that. And even people who leave PhDs and they say, you know, that's why I never applied to a professorial position, because I know that that's the way it's run. And that's why many of my colleagues are also very frustrated. So it's much, much more delicate, and I think we are just a tiny, tiny crack in the wall where people can look through.
Tell me, what does it say about biological science on GM crops and foods when you review the field in just over 8 years or coming up to 10, you have about a dozen peer-reviewed publications. Yeah. All right? Yeah. Well, do you know how much we suffered for that wretched paper in the Lancet? Have you any idea that what actually did happen there? Now, it's all right now, of course, it is published, and it's not been retracted like in his case. I mean, what sort of, what does it again say about our society and about our science that this actually even comes to it, that when you are having a peer-reviewed publication which has been peer-reviewed umpteen times, not what you normally have to honest other scientists looking at it. So here we have a situation. Yes, we managed to publish very important pieces of research. But what you have to ask, that how many other pieces of research which have been done, which should have been done, had not been published. And that is the that will tell you how healthy our state of affairs is in this business.
And, you know, I also want to point out that some of the suppression comes not at the publication stage, but even before that. And I think primarily about the students who, for example, at the University of Florida at Michigan, who got involved in this, and their jobs were to repeat my work and to show that I was wrong. Not to answer a question, not to find the answer, but to find a particular answer. And if they didn't start to find that answer, then, you know, they got shifted on to other projects, or protocols got changed, or experiments got terminated. So, I mean, there's a whole other level of suppression where it doesn't even get to the point where, in that case, they're trying to publish it.
Just to make a point on, and I have to agree a little bit with, and not just because he's from New York, but with Chris Henke from Colgate, in the sense that when I look up my paper on the web, it's been cited, you know, like a couple hundred times or something. Anybody who wants to publish now on non-targets is citing it not always correctly and often bashing it. But the fact is that there are a lot of publications out there now. And I think the point that he's making that, and maybe not it's all that it should be, but there is a sense that now that we're having this debate, we're getting a lot more research on it than we were before any of us did publish on these things, and I think that step forward is healthy. It's maybe not where we should be, but I think I think we're a lot farther along, and I'm not sure everybody's being turned off by the fact that, that we got slapped back. I mean, some people are trying to blaze the trail still.
Here's a question about Michael Pollan and my world, media. Comes from Chris Weber, a graduate student in physics here at the university. Chris asks, have you, any of you, noticed any differences between how the for-profit and the not-for-profit news sources have covered your research and the associated controversies?
Well, I'm glad that in the UK, not always for the better, but my research and the research associated with it had been very widely reported. In fact, one of the questions I try to ask people here, that why is it that there is no similar large exposure of this whole business actually happened in the U.S. I mean, when you look at the, you know, I have a room which probably contains only about a quarter of all the sort of reports in various newspapers published about the controversy of GM crops in the UK, and that room is full. I mean, it is really quite literally a full. And when I ask my friends in the U.S., they always keep complaining that there is very little that gets into the mainstream media. It is important for us because that keeps the story alive. That keeps, if there is a perception, a public perception and a public push for financing more of this work from the public purse, then it is likely that there will be an effect. Maybe not tomorrow, but perhaps it will come along later. So it is extremely important that we should have an interest by the press in our work, even though that in some instances it will not be very good to us because it will say things which is not to our liking. Nevertheless, it is the importance to keep the issue alive.
I wanted to just again at the anecdote of our case, the discovery that David and I made about the contamination of corn in Mexico was covered by Newsweek International as a cover story. So we have cover story, you know, the photograph with in Japanese and in all kinds of different languages. It's very, very cool. Newsweek US did not run a single line on the story. And you go and think whatever you want about it. I think I finally am beginning to get it, and that I thank Michael for opening my eyes to this reality, that I used to think it was only politicians who were followers, you know, who cannot ever move one inch if they don't feel there is popular cover for that move, and they're always behind the public. Michael one day recently opened my eyes to the fact that he said, well, media follows politicians. So it sounds like media, especially in the U.S., is like two steps behind. It needs political cover. Politicians need public cover. So, again, the ball is thrown back at you guys, you know. If you do not hold the feet of these politicians to the fire, they will not provide the cover so that media can provide the coverage so that you get informed. I know it's very simple, and it's getting the all those people off the hook of their responsibilities. But it seems to be true that that's the way it's working. And in the U.S., particularly in this area, it has been really astounding how little coverage we get.
Yolanda Chen, a UC Berkeley scientist, seems to share the impression of some of her peers that there's a little something awry with the peer review process. Could you please comment on how we can reform the peer review process so that we have fair and equal treatment of all authors, regardless of their political nature of the subject matter?
Peer review is a rotten process when you are at the receiving end, I can tell you that. Nevertheless, we haven't got anything better. So what are we going to put in place of it? Like Churchill once said about democracy, it's an absolutely rotten system, but we haven't got anything better. I mean, at least we have a say we know that if something is published, it's not necessarily absolutely true, but at least if we have the guarantee that it had been looked at by other scientists. And it is also one other very important thing about it, that it is retrievable. Because in science communication, knowing that what has been done is the real motor, real engine of further progress. So yes, long live peer-reviewed publications.
Do you always feel that the peers selected are really your peers?
No, but I'm afraid, as I say, this is a system which is not always living up to your expectations. But I think that most of the journals, certainly in previous years, tried to be as fair as possible. For example, they asked for your recommendations. Who you think that should be peer reviewing your paper? Obviously, they are not going to select all, because they think that they are all your friends. But at the same time, any editor worth his salt would be able to see if any of the recommended referees by you are in fact relevant to the field. That is the main. You mustn't have your. Some journals, for example, will ask you to say that who you do not want to referee your papers because they may be personal enemies or working on the same field, who may be having a look at your draft paper, can then just go away and do a piece of work and using a sort of another way and publish it before. This used to happen. It can happen. Even that taken into account, we have not got anything better. We may have to consider extending this peer review, perhaps extending it to post things on the internet and invite peer reviews by other scientists in this field, like it happens in physics. That is the way how it is done. But then you will have to have a guarantee that after this public peer review is done, your paper, if it comes up to the mark, will still be published. Because when in biological sciences, if I disclose some of that information, if it is in the public domain, it will not be published by any reputable journal because they say that it is in the public domain. So we may have to extend that peer review process.
Anyone else on peer review? Here's a question from the brilliant and irrepressible Jules Evans, biologist. He asked it of Dr. Cappella, but I think anyone on this panel could answer this question. Your provocative presentation begs for a paradigm shift in academia. What process or mechanism do you imagine could affect this revolution or evolution given the countervailing political forces at work? Small question.
Tiny question. I wish we had an hour to talk about this, but maybe the only answer I can think of immediately is the negative to that question, and that is, what is the alternative? And I think we're heading that way, which is to make science irrelevant, socially irrelevant. So instead of answering on the positive, on what are the ways that we could change, I think I can say that the way we're going, the problem will be resolved by default, because we're going to make ourselves irrelevant, especially when it comes to complex environmental questions where you have to consider society, when you have to consider humans. People don't want to believe us anymore because they do not know who to trust. They do not know who to go. So they might as well just say, well, I don't like Frankenfoods because I don't like them. And that's it. I don't care what the guy in the white coat says. So I think the key might be to remember that who we're working for, remember who we represent, and especially in a place like this again, it's we're working for the public of California, and somehow reinforcing the links to relevancy, I think would, number one, bring more money to us if that's what we want. If we had spent the same amount of time trying to get money from the legislature as we'd spent trying to get money from Novartis, I bet you that Sacramento would have come around and done something. So remembering that source of our relevance and the fact that, yes, we can become irrelevant might be a key.
Any other thoughts? John? No. Here's a question. How do you, this is to anyone on the panel, how do you think biotechnology is influencing the public understanding of an interest in science?
The only thing I can say that at the moment, in the UK, I don't know what it is in the US, the ranking is politicians, then next to
are we down or up here?
We politicians are at the bottom. Then just a little bit further up, newspaper people, and the next step is scientists. Now you have to consider this very seriously. Because when I started in science in the UK, we were regarded as very important part of the public watchdog system over issues which concern everyone. And when we said something, I don't mean I did say, but for example, the Rawat made some contribution to some issue of animal nutrition. It was taken seriously. It was regarded as that we pay these guys, they can play with their chemistry and biology sets, and they will owe us something in return. And they took it seriously. I can give you many examples of it. Now when you are, just imagine that all those scientists, veterinary scientists, who kept till the very last moment saying that BSE will never cross the species barrier. And they said it time and time again. I'm really ashamed for those scientific colleagues. They did say it. Now what the ordinary public citizen will think of it when the very same guy will have to stand up 2 years later and say it publicly, I'm sorry, this actually did happen. So
And we have got this time and time again that those people, those scientists who were either pushing the government's agenda or the commercial agendas, and they say things which the public will look at it with increasing sort of feeling very uneasy about it. And then when the whole story breaks and the whole thing breaks down, so what do you think that those punters will think about the scientists, these white coat gents who are using our money and having a good time, and in the same process they are misleading us? This is a very, very... Now, for me, I have to say it to you, from the age of 16, I always wanted to be a scientist. I knew what I wanted to do, and I did it. And it comes as a terrible affliction that we come to that stage that if the public will look at some scientist standing up on TV and saying something, they would just say, oh, here we go again. I mean, this is, for me, is a personal tragedy.
Anyone else?
I would probably even take it slightly a step further than that, and I think that debate among scientists or scientists changing their mind tend to cause the public to lose faith in science. And in fact, I think it's often, I know in my case, it's a tool. It's what I call their attempt to confuse the news. That, you know, you make a statement about disagreement. It might be based on something, might be based on nothing. But the point is, I think that they know that if they publicly say, well, we showed this, or there's controversy about that, then they know that people will stop listening to both sides and go, what do they know? They don't know the answer. So I think it's actually quite intentional in some cases. Maybe not all, but...
Any thoughts? I promised you that it would be 2 hours, and it's almost 2 hours. There's actually a question here for the chancellor. Is the chancellor here by any chance? Or anyone from the chancellor's office? I wasn't going to read this question because it comes from David Noble in Toronto, who some of you. Know. He's a well-known science historian, author of The Religion of Technology, and what was his other book, America by Design, which I'm sure a lot of you have read or heard of. David Noble, and the reason I'm going to read this question is because a lot of the other people in the room and on the internet asked essentially the same question. So it's kind of a compilation of questions, but I'm going to just read David Noble's because it's very articulately worded. And please, when I come up for tenure, remember, I'm reading someone else's question. This is not me asking this question. David Noble asks, how does Chancellor Berdahl's conflict of interest stemming from his directorship of Lam Research Corporation, for which he is handsomely paid, reportedly $40,000 a year, how does it distort his decision regarding cases like Chappelle's? Maybe one day we'll get an answer from the Chancellor to that question. That's it. Unless you have any closing remarks.
I want to make an opening remark. I want to make this the beginning of something, and as far as my strength goes, and I will make every effort to keep this open and moving forward. It's not a closing at all.
understand the cards?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.